Kia ora and welcome to Airman's Podcast, episode 262. Today is Wednesday, September 7, 2011. Today's is a special episode because the majority of it is going to be the valedictory speech of Member of Parliament Chris Carter, who I've talked about before, and I'll talk about why I'm playing it a little bit later on. But basically, the reason I am playing it is because this is my busiest week of the month, and I don't have time for a proper podcast right now, and also because I did want to play it. And I'll talk more about the reasons later on. But first, I have some bits and pieces from the New Zealand news. As you probably remember, we recently had the six-month, not anniversary, but six-month observance or whatever, of the deadly February earthquake in Christchurch, and the one that killed the people and caused all the damage and that we're still dealing with. But we also just recently passed the first anniversary of the quake in September of last year that started it all. That was, in some ways, the foreshock, it's now sometimes called, to the later events, especially the deadly earthquake in February. And this has been in the news because recently the estimates of how much this is going to cost the Earthquake Commission, or EQC, is sort of like our national savings account for disasters. We all pay into it through levies on home and contents insurance and car insurance. And over 20 years, we've built up this fund to pay for a natural disaster. Well, the costs have more than doubled to 7.1 billion New Zealand dollars. And that has wiped out the Earthquake Commission's disaster fund. That's it. One swoop and it's gone. Now, the reality is that if there was another disaster, the government would have to stump up money to cover it. And the whole point of the EQC was that we were saving money, putting money aside so that in the event of a natural disaster, it wouldn't all have to come out of the government coffers at once. It's just that if there's another natural disaster, that's not going to be there to fall back on. And the current estimate, well, this week the Prime Minister said that nobody knows how much the final quake damage bill will be. And as it is right now, the total bill, which includes private insurance as well, is inching ever so close to 25 billion New Zealand dollars. And it's only going to get worse. And one of the reasons why this is so bad, and I like to keep harping on this to give some sense of perspective, in terms of the disaster as a percentage of GDP, the earthquake in Christchurch is one of the most expensive natural disasters in world history, certainly in modern world history. Now, it is absolutely true that Katrina or the earthquake and tsunami in Japan killed more people, caused more damage in dollar terms, all those sorts of things, displaced more people. But in terms of how much of the national economy will be taken up with a disaster, there are very few events that top the Christchurch earthquake. And that's because we're such a small country. Katrina and obviously the Japanese events happen in bigger countries, and it's not as much of a financial drain because of that. So it's all relative, obviously. And I'm certainly not trying to demean or belittle those other bigger events. That's not the point. My point is just that this is a small country, and a disaster like this hits home in so many ways, including financially. And it's going to be, I would guess, easily 10 to 20 years before Christchurch is fully rebuilt. And, of course, it'll take even longer for people to recover from their personal loss of family members or loved ones or friends or acquaintances, whatever. But it's going to be a big and expensive process. And a lot of this has been in the forefront of people's minds in recent days because the Royal Commission on the Earthquake has resumed its deliberations or whatever you call it. And there have been some absolutely heart-wrenching tales about the last moments of some people's lives and what happened to them and so on. And some people who were alive and who survived the initial earthquake, but who later died of their injuries because they couldn't be freed. And, strangers who would, there was one man who died in the CTV building, and he was trapped in the debris. They couldn't free him. And strangers were coming up to him, holding his hand to keep him company, until he finally did die because they couldn't get him out in time. And so stories like that you hear and you're just like, oh no. So it's very much on people's minds. There's also the Royal Commission of Inquiry into the Pike River mine disaster, which is going on. And there's been kind of a bit of a bombshell, really, in that there is now the belief that some miners anyway survived the initial blast in the mine. And so then the question then becomes, why didn't they mount a rescue? Did they not know this? What's the story here? And so this is all to be played out. But one of the two survivors of the blast, after it happened, he tried to make a call on the emergency line, and it didn't work. They went to an emergency station. The phone there didn't work, and all of the equipment had been removed. And the mine operators say, well, that had been decommissioned. And he said, nobody ever told us. In fact, they treated us, generally speaking, like dogs. And so now we're beginning to find out the truth about the operators of the mine, and they weren't necessarily very nice people. So it's all this drama going on behind the scenes. And, of course, on Friday is something completely different. It's the beginning of the Rugby World Cup, and the first game is between New Zealand and Tonga. Now, somewhere, and I don't know where they're getting these from, people are selling these little flags that you put on the driver's side, which, of course, is the right side of the car in New Zealand, on the roof by the door frame or whatever it is. And the first time I saw one of these was, I think, over the weekend. We were driving, and I saw somebody with an American flag on the car. And, of course, I always notice American flags. And I said to Nigel, I wonder why they're doing that. And then he reminded me of the Rugby World Cup. I was like, oh, yeah. So then I was driving around, and I saw somebody with a Samoan flag on their car. And the other day, I was coming back from the grocery store, and I was coming down the road, and I looked, and there's this giant Tongan flag flying from somebody's house. Not giant, it was, normal 3x5 or whatever. Much bigger than the car ones is what I meant, giant in that sense. And so this good news, this positive stuff is helping, I think, to kind of, moderate, I guess, a lot of what has been really quite sad news over the past couple of weeks, really. And so that's a good thing. And that all starts on Friday with the opening ceremonies and then that first game. I don't know when the first game of the USA Eagles is, because I quite frankly don't pay that much attention to rugby anymore. But hopefully in my next podcast I'll be able to talk about that a little bit anyway. My next podcast, I do have voicemail messages and comments on that whole business about prepositions and things, and other stuff as well. And I'll get to that in the next one. But for this episode, I thought that I would like to do something different and play the valedictory message of Chris Carter. He's leaving Parliament to take up a position with the United Nations in Kabul, Afghanistan, which is not the first place I'd want to go, I can tell you. But it's a big deal for him, this on the international stage, and he's starting basically a new career. He and his partner have been together for 38 years, which is kind of amazing in itself. Now, I have talked about him before, and I've talked about the whole mess he got himself into with his attempted coup to depose Phil Goff as leader of the Labour Party and how they expelled him from caucus as a result and all that sort of stuff. I'm not going to rehash all of that, and that's all easily available. In fact, it's probably even in his Wikipedia page. I assume he has one. But the important things, I think, about this at this stage are this. He was the first openly gay member of Parliament. He was elected in 1993 in the electorate of Te Atatu, which is in West Auckland. And he was defeated for re-election in 1996 for convoluted reasons, and then was re-elected back in 1999 and served continuously until now. He was also the first openly gay cabinet minister, rising eventually to the position of education minister, which is number 7 in the rankings of the cabinet. And he was also conservation minister and minister for ethnic affairs. He was acting prime minister at one stage during Christmas break, when both the prime minister and the deputy prime minister were out of the country. He represented New Zealand at President Gerald Ford's funeral in the U.S. And he, in his speech, he talks a bit about breaking the glass ceiling, because there was him, Tim Barnett, and Georgina Beyer, who were the original Rainbow Caucus in Parliament. Chris, of course, as I said, was the first openly gay MP, although he did not come out until after he was elected. He technically never hid anything, never denied it, or tried to deceive anybody, but he didn't actually come out and say anything until his maiden speech in Parliament in 1993. Tim Barnett, on the other hand, who used to be the MP for Christchurch Central, and now has a job, I think it's for the World Health Organization, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, he was the first openly gay person elected to a first term in a national parliament. Now, what that means is that all of the others came out, even if it's only technically, as in Chris Carter's case, after they were elected, whereas Tim Barnett was openly gay in his campaign and was elected as an openly gay man for his first term. It was the first time that it ever happened. It since has happened elsewhere, including in the United States, of course, and other places. And Georgina Beyer was the world's first transgender member of a national legislature. And she had been mayor of Carterton in the Wairarapa before that. And I actually don't know what she's doing nowadays since she left Parliament. She was on Dancing with the Stars. Oh, that's actually a little aside. I do not understand why the right wing in America is so apoplectic over Chaz Bono being on Dancing with the Stars. I mean, they hate GLBT people. I know all that. But I don't really get it, because our version of Dancing with the Stars has already had Georgina Beyer, a transgendered woman, and has had an openly gay man, Timothy Coffey, who actually won the competition and gave his money to Rainbow Youth, his prize money, which is a gay and lesbian, transgender, bisexual, questioning, blah, 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 agency here in Auckland. So this is nothing for us. We don't get what the big deal is here. And actually, I suspect that most normal people in America don't understand why the radical right in America is going so crazy over that. But anyway, sorry for the digression, because I know I won't remember later. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play his valedictory speech in its entirety. It's about 22 minutes. There's nothing after that except the usual closing, music contact details and so on. So you don't have to stick around if you really don't want to listen to it. But I thought I would play it because he talks about his time in Parliament, his years in the Clark-led Labour government, and he talks about some of the things that he did. Now, there's a lot of me, as these things tend to be. But I do think it gives an insight into some of what it was like during those years, most of which were before this podcast began, of course. And also, this is not the sort of thing that most people overseas would hear. And so for all those reasons, and because I'm too busy to do a full podcast today, I thought I would play that instead. Now, I will be back soon, hopefully the end of the week, if not, then early next week with a regular episode, and I'll go over all the comments and voicemails and whatever. And I think that this Sunday I'm going to be joining Nigel for the Third Colony on farpointradio.com, but I'm not positive of that because he hasn't said whether he's doing that or not. He's just changed his server and host and all that stuff, so he's been in the process of getting everything all reorganized and reset up again. And we've been away on holiday, so he just hasn't had a chance to get that all ready to go yet, I don't think. So I don't know. We may be, or maybe not. Watch my Twitter account. And it's not mentioned in the credits, so you can follow me on Twitter at Amerinz Podcast, AMERINZ Podcast, one word. And that's where I post bits and pieces about the podcast and when a new episode is released and all kinds of bits and pieces. I post stuff about the podcast there more than on any other account that I use. So that is it for today, and possibly this week, I'm not sure. And now, here is the valedictory message from the Honourable Chris Carter.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, all satisfying stories should have a clear beginning and a conclusive end. This is the conclusive end of my parliamentary story, but I hope not the end of any opportunities I might have to do some public good in the world. I'd like to use this opportunity to reflect on some of the highlights of the 15 years I've served as a Member of Parliament for Te Atatu. But before I do that, Mr. Speaker, I need to acknowledge some rather special people who are here today. This year, my partner, Peter Kaiser, and I celebrate 38 years as a couple. We met in 1973 when we were both very young students and have been together ever since. Nothing I have achieved in my life has been possible without his support and his energy. In politics, he's canvassed as many houses as me, delivered as many leaflets as me, attended as many conferences and regional meetings as me, raised the money for our party levies, and hosted numerous Labour Party functions in our home, including Helen Clark's 60th birthday party. He organised a lot, and as many of my former Labour colleagues can attest, without Peter's contribution, Auckland regional Labour Party politics would have struggled, particularly during the difficult political period between 1993 and 1998. He has served at all levels of the Labour Party up to and including the executive of the New Zealand Council, the ruling body of the party. He has served as an area representative and was chair of the Auckland Regional Council of the Labour Party for many years. Together, we founded Rainbow Labour, the gay and lesbian sector of the Labour Party. In the good times and the bad, he was always there for me and for the Labour Party. Many people, including me, urged him last year to take my place as the Labour MP for Te Aritu. He would easily have won this election and the election, but he wouldn't have a bar of it. Successful relationships are often difficult for MPs to sustain, as many in this House have found. The stresses of the job, living part of the week away from home for non-Wellington members, and the intrusion of media into our personal lives all have a high personal and relationship cost. Peter has put up with all the costs of being a reluctant public figure for me. He is a successful and popular school principal, and the last 2 years in politics have been enormously difficult and stressful for him, as media have unfairly dragged him into the spotlight. It's an acknowledgement of the respect that he has earned that no matter how nasty or unfair media stories have been about us, he remains a much-loved, respected and valued member of his school community. To be honest, for 15 years, Te Aritu and the Labour Party actually had two MPs for the price of one. I know he's very happy that I'm leaving politics, but I will always be indebted to his support and contribution during the time I've been a politician. The children of MPs also have a heavy burden to bear. Our three children, Alice, Willem and Oliver, have not had an easy time with me as a public figure and often worried about how they coped, particularly during the last year. I want to acknowledge today, for the record, my appreciation of the friendship and support of a large group of people in my electorate. Without their help and encouragement, I could not have achieved the support I won from my constituents. Jenny Atkins, the long-time secretary of our LEC, and her daughter Adele, Margaret Sutton and her family, Neville Tilsey, Bill Guy, John Edgar, Claudia Elliott, Shirley Swanepoel and Verity Davidson, Mary Bragg, George O'Donnell, Morris and Barbara Carlisle, also Anna Arald Hansen, Rex and Marilyn Hurley, Brian Hennigan, John Wakenshaw, Anne Parler, Mahindra Taylor, Camille Nakheed and her husband George, Shane Misselbrook, Lincoln Dam, Pon Locke, Roy Clements, George Bache, Imad Khan, Haseeb Metla, Zhang Shibo, and many, many more. Without the support of these friends and supporters, we could never have kept the Labour flag flying out west so successfully and won five elections so comfortably. I cannot thank them enough for their personal support and friendship. The unanimous support and repeated endorsement I received from my electorate committee last year meant a great deal to me. I probably appreciated even more, Mr. Speaker, their commitment over many years to knock on doors, dodge dogs, and deliver thousands and thousands of leaflets and target letters, fundraise, and provide me with their collective wisdom on everything from major policy issues to the content of my numerous electorate newsletters. Staff have always been very important to me and to my success as a politician. I can truthfully say, Mr. Speaker, that it was my staff more than anything else that I missed the most when I ceased to be a Cabinet Minister. I would like to acknowledge my two electorate secretaries, Margaret Sutton and Diane Monteith. Margaret has been with me since the beginning in 1993, and her Irish background and sense of humour have seen us all through so much. Wendy Hogg, Shibo Zhang and Tao Ren were also long-time local staff and made a huge and valued contribution. Joy Bridge, Brian Hennigan, Latofa Tanilau and David Taylor were among the many volunteers that have helped out on a regular basis in my Henderson office. In 2000, Serge Sabalak, a recent immigrant from the former Yugoslavia, came as a Victoria University intern to my office. We discovered we had so much in common, even the same birthday. He came for 7 months and stayed for 7 years. Over time, he became more like a son to me than a staff member. As a minister, I had two skilled, wise and valued political advisers, Kevin Smith and Michael Gibbs. Both became friends as well as staff and did amazing work for me and for our country. For 5 years, Nick Mailing was my long-suffering but much-valued press secretary, adviser and friend. Others who made a huge difference to my success as a government minister included Richard Marshall, Gavin Rodley, Steve Boyd, Elizabeth Brown, Becky Chin, Elizabeth McMillan, Stephen Cross, Leroy Taylor, Jay Eden, Daniel King, Peter Grezza, Simon Gilmore, Helen Lattinen and Brett de Melmotch. After the 2011 election, I had two parliamentary staff, David Hawkins and then Tim Carno. Both have served me and my constituents well. I owe them and my other staff a huge thank you for their loyalty and hard work. I'd also like to acknowledge the fine chief executives that I had the privilege of working with as a government minister. Hugh Logan and Al Morrison at DOC, Sonia Rathkin and Mervyn Singham at Ethnic Affairs, Chris Blake and Brendan Boyle at Internal Affairs, Katrina Bache at Building and Housing, Leslie McTurk and Pat Sneddon at Housing New Zealand, and Karen Sewell at Education. The American politician, former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Tip O'Neill, made that famous quote, "All politics are local." The local, Mr. Speaker, was always the part of the job I loved the best. I've tried to work hard on behalf of my constituents. My majority at the last election was the highest of any Labor MP in West Auckland, even though Labor narrowly lost the party vote in my electorate. That personal support was earned by never taking support for granted and consistently providing a service. I can truthfully say that there is not a house in my electorate or a letterbox or probably even a dog that I do not know personally. Local achievements that I feel particularly satisfied about include saving at least half the harbour view land in Te Aritu Peninsula as a public park, helping to expand public services at Waitakere Hospital, numerous local school projects, support for the Ark and the Park project in the Waitakere Ranges, and support with my two Labor colleagues in West Auckland for the Waitakere Ranges protection legislation. On a more personal level, the innumerable immigration, housing, ACC, IRD and other constituency cases that came through my local office often had a life-changing impact on individuals' lives. Nothing can be more satisfying than helping people in such a practical and direct way. At the end of any politician's time in Parliament, I imagine all of us will reflect on what was our legacy in Parliament. Did the time spent in this place make a difference to our country and its people? I'd like to think that the 15 years I spent here, particularly the 6 years I spent as a Cabinet Minister, did make a positive difference. I've always been a very goal-focused individual who wanted to get things done yesterday. Every ministerial job I had, and I was entrusted with quite a few, saw lots happening. I'd like to touch on just a few of the highlights. Conservation was the job I enjoyed the most. During the 5 years I spent as Conservation Minister, the longest anyone has held that position to date, over 360,000 hectares of land was added to the conservation estate, an area more than twice the size of Stewart Island. Of all my actions as a government minister, this land acquisition program on behalf of the public is the achievement I am most proud of. Long after I'm forgotten, I know that land will be protected, accessible, and an asset for every New Zealander. The Cabinet approved the money, but my energy and determination drove the process forward. Other highlights for me were the gazetting of 17 new marine reserves. Creating, Mr. Speaker, each one felt at times like fighting World War III, but marine reserves do work. This is a controversial process, and I'm not surprised that very few have been created since I left the job in 2007. Worried about the sale of private coastal camping grounds to property developers, I managed to gazette 100 new camping grounds on the Dock Estate while I was Minister. I also extended protection to a number of marine species, including the endangered great white shark. I particularly enjoyed the media announcement made in the Chathams in a wetsuit and underwater in a shark cage. No wonder my Cabinet colleagues often teased me about those photo opportunities I had as Conservation Minister. I signed staff agreements between DOC and the state conservation agencies in Italy, the Philippines, South Africa and Canada, giving my department expertise a chance to be shared with others globally. I negotiated and implemented regional assistance and training for Environment and Park Service staff from Papua New Guinea, New Caledonia, the Solomons, Tonga, Samoa, Niue and Fiji, a move that complemented New Zealand's regional assistance work in the Pacific. I battled Japanese, Norwegian and Icelandic whalers at 5 IWC meetings, putting New Zealand in the world spotlight as the most staunch anti-whaling nation. I initiated and actively pursued a huge number of individual biodiversity and recreational projects, the most exciting of which was Project Hauraki, the establishment of Rangitoto and Motutapu Islands in the Hauraki Gulf as pest-free, with the potential to become another Tiri Tiri Matangi on the steps or doorstep of Auckland. None of these projects could have happened without, of course, my Cabinet colleagues' support and Cabinet approval, but I was the man entrusted to get the job done, and I relished doing it. For 6 years, I served as New Zealand's Minister of Ethnic Affairs, again to date the longest any individual has held that particular portfolio. Mr. Speaker, being Minister of Ethnic Affairs was not a job Cabinet colleagues were queuing up to take. Why was that? Well, quite simply, the workload. If you valued any free time on weekends, being Minister of Ethnic Affairs was not a job for you. Over 6 years, I visited almost every mosque, Gurdwara, that's a Sikh temple, Buddhist temple, Hindu temple and synagogue in New Zealand, and there are an awful lot of them. I celebrated Buddha's birthday on numerous occasions at temples in Auckland, Wellington and Christchurch. I watched kabaddi competitions, a sort of Punjabi bull rush, at Sikh temples, was splattered with paint powder at Hindu holy festivals, attended religious services for Indian Christians, Greek Catholics, Iraqi Christians, Lebanese Christians and Russian Orthodox, was splashed with water at Sokran, the Thai water festival, danced the night away at Nowruz, Iranian New Year, celebrated each year Eid, and launched the annual Islam Awareness Week, and enjoyed Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year. Over the last 10 years, Mr. Speaker, I must have attended at least 60 Diwali events, countless Chinese New Year events, as well as the annual Hindu Navratri Festival. In addition to these religious services, most of the over 184 different national and ethnic groups who make up modern New Zealand also like to celebrate their national days as a focus for their community members resident in New Zealand. The drums of Ghana's, Burundi, Rwanda, the Congo and Nigeria's national days became as familiar to me as the traditional dances of Croatia, Bulgaria, Russia, Ukraine, Korea and Romania. On one notable occasion, Mr. Speaker, in 2005, I attended 8 ethnic festivals in Auckland on one Saturday, followed by 5 more the next day. Significant achievements that I'm proud of completing during those years as ethnic minister included the establishment of Language Line, a professional telephone interpreting service using 39 languages that allowed people with little or no English to access government services, the Connecting Diverse Communities Work Program, a whole-of-government approach containing more than 70 initiatives across government agencies to improve policies aimed at strengthening positive relations between diverse ethnic, cultural and religious groups. The Building Bridges Initiative, launched in 2006 in conjunction with the New Zealand Federation of Islamic Associations to help dispel Muslim stereotypes in the post-9/11 environment. The Cultural Awareness and Communication Program, which saw the Office of Ethnic Affairs staff provide specialist services, advice and training to other government agencies to help facilitate better cultural and religious understanding in New Zealand. The initiation of the annual UK-New Zealand Dialogue on Multicultural Communities and exchange of policies and best practice between my Office of Ethnic Affairs and the UK Department of Community and Local Government. Helen Clark's decision for Parliament to celebrate annually Chinese New Year, the Hindu festival and the Muslim festival of Eid, which of course is happening tonight, was a message to all of New Zealand that our country was now home to many cultures and religions, and all of them have value and are part of our evolving national identity. I also initiated at Parliament during my time as Minister the celebration of Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, and a significant celebration in 2008 of 150 years of Croatian settlement in our country. Other ministerial jobs that I had included that of Minister of Local Government, which saw me responsible for the passage of the new Local Government Act in 2002, and a major overhaul of dog legislation, always a very controversial subject. As Minister of Building Issues, I was responsible for the passage of the new Building Act in 2004 and a review of the Residential Tenancies Act in the same year, and the passage of the Retirement Villages Act during my time in that portfolio. I had a brief spell as Acting Minister of Pacific Island Affairs and was appointed Housing Minister in 2005. I'm proud that under my watch, Housing New Zealand increased the quantity of social housing by another 1,923 housing units, increased the provision of community group housing units, and introduced a shared equity scheme to allow better opportunities to boost first home ownership. We also significantly expanded the community renewal program, which saw big concentrations of social housing undergo major renovation and community development. My last job in government, Mr. Speaker, was that of Education Minister. As a former teacher, I was immensely proud to be promoted to the 7th ranked cabinet position responsible for New Zealand's education system. When Helen Clark informed me I was going to be appointed Education Minister, she said I'd done such a good job selling the Labour-led government's successes in conservation that we had an equally great story to tell in education. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, Labour had. Over 8 years, Labour had doubled the education budget from $5 billion to $10 billion. The Capital Works program for schools alone was an astonishing $3.3 billion. 42 new schools were built, and expenditure on early childhood education increased by 281%. Two personal education initiatives I was very proud of were a major package to try and address the scourge of bullying in schools and a ban on the sale of junk food in school tuck shops. Both at the time were condemned by the opposition as PC and the nanny state gone mad. Yet surely keeping students safe and trying to address the rising rate of childhood obesity was just plain good sense. I was very proud of these and the many other investments Labour made in the educational sector during our time in office. I only had 14 months in the job, but I worked hard to justify Helen Clark's faith in me. During that time, Mr. Speaker, I personally visited 327 schools and early childhood centres to see education in practice. I hope my presence and interest encouraged the excellent teaching and learning I witnessed happening in our classrooms. Mr. Speaker, I was the first MP to openly acknowledge being gay, although I'm sure I wasn't the first gay MP to enter this Parliament. Why did I choose to be the first to be open about my different sexuality? As a former teacher, I knew that gay and lesbian teenagers faced huge amounts of prejudice and had few affirming messages or positive role models. By being open and honest about my sexuality, and joined soon by my industrious gay colleague, Tim Barnett, and my remarkable transsexual colleague, Labour colleague, Georgina Beyer, we broke a glass ceiling. Today, having gay and lesbian MPs is no big deal, and thank goodness for that. In 2007, I met a beautiful young Māori woman in Melbourne who told me, as a 15-year-old, she'd been seriously contemplating suicide because of her sexuality. I'd come to her school prize giving, and my presence, she said, convinced her that being gay was not a barrier to personal success. She told me tearfully that I had saved her life. That story alone, Mr. Speaker, made it all worthwhile. The people that have inspired me in this place have included Helen Clark, a remarkable and inspirational leader who made me proud to be a New Zealander. Michael Cullen, a man who knew how to build and maintain a strong economy. Margaret Wilson, Steve Mahari, David Longy, individuals of great intellectual ability. My friends, Jonathan Hunt, Charles Chevelle, Leanne Dalziel, Jill Pettis, Martin Gallagher, Judith Tizard, Mark Burton, David Benson Pope, Rick Barker, Ashraf Chowdhury, Raymond Hoare, Rajin Prasad and George Hawkins. Thanks for your support and friendship, often rare commodities in this place. The last year has not been easy, but now is the time to look forward and not back. I am and will always be a Labour person. I still consider myself a Labour MP, and I still believe passionately in social democracy and that the Labour Party has the best philosophy for ensuring social justice and providing effective pathways to realising individual potential. The state should and must play a positive role in providing services and creating opportunity for all. I will remind those who seek leadership here in Parliament that strong leadership is about strong policies, rooted not in opportunism or pandering to the press gallery, but in values that reflect your own political philosophy and your own personal ethics. Loyalty is a two-way process. It is earned and is not an automatic right. I want to take this opportunity to thank the Greens, who have been so kind to me. You truly have the nicest political culture here at Parliament, and I want to thank Green MPs for all the support you've given me this year. Mr. Speaker, where to from here for me? I've been appointed to a senior UN position, and I look forward to making, over the next few years, a contribution to the UN's global mission. It's time for a change for me, but I will always consider that it was an honour and a privilege to have served as a West Auckland representative here in Parliament for 15 years. Thank you very much.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.